For having me. I don't know, this Steve's already done the thing about my first time here. This is my first time here, and I am certainly feeling exactly what Steve felt before. These guys are nutters, and they scream and shout more than most people do. There was quite a few bits of information. Why don't you just turn and say hi to somebody you don't know within reach of you. If there is somebody near you that you don't know, why don't you just go and say hi, welcome them if you don't already know them. Okay. Right, well, good morning, and thank you so much for having me. You guys, it looks a little bit full in here. I think you should go to two meetings. That's my razor sharp insight from me. I want to do a slightly different kind of talk. Often if you come to a church like this, if you're new, if you've never been in a church like this, or if you've been to church once or twice before, maybe you're not a Christian, you're visiting, someone's invited you to come. I want you to know I'm mainly speaking to you today, having had an experience myself of coming to churches like this for the first time and been a little freaked out. I feel I'd probably know a little bit of what it's like, and I chatted to a couple who came to our church. I helped lead a church in Eastbourne. Spoke to a couple recently who came into they came to church for the first time, went into the welcome area afterwards, and I said, "Hey guys, you know, really nice to meet you. Thanks so much for coming. How did you find the meeting?" And they said, "It's a bit like a cult, really." And obviously you're trained not to say anything at that point. So I went, "Okay, wow. So what? Tell me why. You know, how did it feel like that?" So just hundreds and hundreds of people, hands in the air, singing to something that they couldn't see, that isn't really there. I just thought it was really weird. And I thought that was actually quite a helpful little moment. And for me, I thought, yes, of course, that is pretty much what I thought when I first came into a church like this. And it's easy to forget. And I'm kind of talking to you if you relate to that at all. And this is my goal today. I hope it will help the rest of you as well. But I know that there'll be a number here for whom discussions about all those things that we're singing about just really, there's just far too many obstacles for you to get there at the moment, just with thinking about them. And so I want to start with a question that comes from the end of The Lord of the Rings, which I think is a question that all of us need to be either haunted by or enchanted by, depending on the answer. And the question is this: Samwise Gamgee, who most of you have seen The Lord of the Rings, if you haven't, you probably haven't lived, so that's fine. Sam, who's played by Sean Astin, at the end of the movie, there's a moment in the book which is kind of, the line is different in the movie, but in the book, the line is, he turns to Gandalf and he says, "Gandalf, I thought you were dead, but then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue? What's happened to the world?" This is just after the ring has been thrown into the lake and the whole world is being remade. And Sam says, "I thought I was dead and I don't understand. What's happened to the world?" And then this amazing question, which should haunt or enchant us all, which is everything sad going to come untrue? And I think that there's almost no more challenging or important question for people today to wrestle with. And that's not just because we've seen the events we have in Kenya and in Peshawar, Pakistan, over the last few days. Even if you hadn't seen the news, the question that we should all be confronted with at some point is everything sad going to come untrue one day? Is there redemption? It might be a Christian word for it. The ancient Hebrews referred to it as shalom. It's a wonderful word. It's like sort of a global harmony and peace coming to everything. A fixing things that Israel's God's going to do. It's such a powerful word that you still go in the Middle East today, and if you see a Jewish person, you say shalom, and if you see an Arabic person, you say salam alaikum, whatever, but it's still this, may peace, may shalom, may this harmony come upon you. And it's not just, "Hi, how's it going?" It's a deeper, richer thing than that. And the question that we need to ask is that ever going to happen or not? Is it a pipe dream or is it reality? Is there redemption? Is there restoration for all things? And Tolkien told the Lord of the Rings story the way he did, with a very Christian perspective on things, to drive home that point, that when the ring, when the source of evil in the world is finally cast into the fire, is everything sad going to come untrue? And the question's left hanging for those of us who live in a world plagued by cancer and miscarriages and grief and bereavement and divorce and massacres in shopping centers and churches. Is everything sad going to come untrue? I want to say, whether you've read a Bible ever, whether you ever intend to or not, that question is about as important a question as there is. Is there redemption? Is shalom coming? Is the righting of wrongs ever going to happen, or is this it? Are we carrying on with what we've got now indefinitely? And if you don't know an answer to that question that satisfies you emotionally, existentially, intellectually, even if you don't know what any of those three things mean, you need to ask that question. Is everything sad going to come untrue? The Lord of the Rings is obviously fictional, but that question is designed to prompt us to the most real type of things we can wrestle with. Is there a future hope? Is there peace coming? Or are we stuck with this? Is there redemption for cholera and Pakistan churches being whatever? Is there redemption? Is there hope? And my main aim this morning is to persuade you that you should want the answer to be yes, if you don't already, and that if you want the answer to be yes, you really should want the Christian story to be true, whether or not it is. Now, obviously, I wouldn't be here if I didn't think it was. I can't pretend that I've got no stake in this. No, but everybody does. Everybody who ever writes an article or makes a statement about anything has a perspective they want others to share. My perspective is that the Christian story is true, but I want to put it to you that even if you don't believe it is, you should really want it to be. I want to explain why I think that's true. See, as far as I can tell, nobody in the world believes that there is going to be redemption for all things. I use that word redemption, which is a Christian word, or shalom, which is the Hebrew word, or everything sad coming untrue is Sam Gamgee's Hobbit word for it. All right, I'm using those things the same way. I think they mean the same kind of thing in this context. And the only people who think that everything sad is going to come untrue in the world are Jews and Christians, as far as I know. And it may be that there is a worldview out there somewhere that I haven't yet encountered, but as far as I know, the only people who answer Sam's question with a yes are Jews and Christians. Everybody else either redefines what they think will happen, or they say a flat out no, and they're very honest about it. No, everything sad's not going to come untrue. But if I just quickly rattle through a few different ways of looking at the world, and I want to put it to you that if the question, is everything sad going to come untrue, gets framed to one of these people and they know their stuff, they will come back and quite honestly say no, in different ways. So a Muslim will say, no, everything sad is not going to come untrue. What instead happens is that when we die, the body and the world continue in the state they are now, and we go to be in paradise. But the world doesn't get redeemed. That's not the way the worldview works in Islam. If you talk to a Hindu, they don't believe that everything sad is going to come untrue. They believe, of course, in cycles. They believe in reincarnation. They believe in karma. They believe in an ongoing process. But the idea of restoring the world and making it all new so that everything that's awful gets undone and remade and rebirthed is not part of the worldview. It doesn't work like that. That's just simply not what they believe. If you talk to a Buddhist, they don't believe in that either. They, of course, believe that the destiny of the human, when one reaches whatever you might call it, or enlightenment, is actually a form of extinction. We use the word nirvana, but that's what it really means. It's actually a sort of a dissolution of the self and the soul. And so with all of these different perspectives, and certainly if you talk to most people in Bedford who would be probably secular, so they don't have a Christian view of the world, they would say, no, everything sad is not going to come untrue. They might not frame it quite like this, but basically there are atoms bouncing off one another on a little piece of rock that's flying like a slingshot around the outside of a very small star at the end of a very large galaxy, and they die sometimes, and they all do, and then they rot, and that's the end. And no, everything sad, that's just the wrong question. Of course everything sad's not going to come untrue. Of course there's no redemption for what's just happened in Kenya, or what's just happened in Pakistan, or what's just happened in your life or mine. It's just ridiculous to think that way. There are some happinesses, and they offset the sadnesses if you're middle class. For many people in the world, they don't, and that's just the way things are. And most people don't talk like that, but that's underneath the view of the world. There is no shalom or redemption, and no, everything sad doesn't come untrue. And so I'm putting it to you today that if you have a stake in the idea of the world being fixed, then you should want the Christian story to be true. Even if it isn't. Now, clearly, if it isn't, you need to reject it and get out of here. So do I. But you need to find out if it is, because we are pretty much the only people around today who are declaring that there is redemption for the world. And it has a very unique shape, which I'm going to explain in a moment, but just want to use an analogy, if you like, to help understand the way that the Christian perspective on this is different from the other perspectives I've just mentioned, from other worldly ways of thinking about things. And I'm a Liverpool fan, so it's been a good season for us so far, apart from the other day. How many Liverpool fans in the room? Yes. Thank you very much. On both sides and none in the middle. That is a very good analogy for supporting Liverpool. You're either doing really well or really badly, but you're never in the middle. That's just the reality of Liverpool fans. You lose to Southampton or you're beating Manchester United, but you're never kind of drawing with... never mind, let's just stop that now. But the highlight of my football watching life was 8 years ago in 2005, Liverpool was in the Champions League final against AC Milan, who, let's face it, were palpably much better than Liverpool. No question about it. They had all the best players in the world at that time pretty much playing for them, and they were certainly going to win. And they went 1-0 up, and then they went 2-0 up, and then they went 3-0 up, and then it went half-time. And I went out into the garden to play a bit of football myself, and then thought, I have just got to throw in the towel, I might go home. But something compelled me to stay, because I believe in redemption. I believe in everything sad becoming untrue. And so I hung in there and I thought, I wonder what will happen here. Now, redemption for the Liverpool fan in that context, redemption looks like this. Steven Gerrard putting in the goal and the Clive Tilsley going, Gerrard, hello. And everyone's like, yes, here we go. You watch it now on replay and you think this is awesome. And then the second goal goes in from Vladimir Smica, who'd never done anything useful for Liverpool ever. And then the third goal goes in, Xabi Alonso, and then Liverpool win on penalties. And Liverpool, despite not really having even been the best team in Britain that year, win the Champions League. And it's the highlight of my football watching life. And sorry if you are Italian in here, but it was a great moment. Now, that's what redemption looks like. That's the Christian take on what redemption is. You're 3-0 down, everything's gone awful, people are weeping and crying, and some of them are leaving the stadium to go home, and they miss the second half, which is gutting. You'd really feel bad if you'd spent all that money. Anyway, that's the Christian view of redemption, is that everything sad becomes untrue. Everything gets fixed and turned and gets restored to the point that sadness gets turned into celebration and mourning gets turned to joy and defeat gets turned into victory. That's what redemption is. Now, that is the view of the world that Christians have about creation. There's been awfulness, there has been sadness, there's been grief, there's been destruction, but God is on the case, and through what he's doing and has done in and through Jesus and the gift of his Spirit, he's turning creation around, and that when finally all wrongs are righted, we see everything but sad becoming untrue. That's the Christian view. That's like winning a football match from 3-0 down. Muslims effectively would say what happens is not that you come back from 3-0 down to win on penalties. Instead, what really happens is that at the end of the game, you get to go and sit in the stand and watch another game take place. You're removed from the pitch and you go somewhere else and you observe. But there's no sense that, and you might enjoy sitting in the stand, but there's no sense of turnaround or redemption or fixing it. If you were to ask a Hindu, you might say, actually what happens is the game keeps on being played. You lost that one, but you might win the next one. So it goes round again, and then you lose the next one, and then you lose, and it just keeps going round and round in circles, and you just don't know at the end of it all whether the game will be won or lost. It's like an ongoing penalty shootout that never stops. If you ask a Buddhist, and there, I'm just using the analogy, but work with me on it. If you ask a Buddhist to say, what happens is at full time, even if you've lost, the pitch just disappears, and so do all the players. That is effectively, in the analogy, that's effectively the Buddhist understanding of nirvana. I'm not mocking it as such. I'm simply saying that's the answer to the question. No, everything sad doesn't get redeemed. That's not what they believe. If you're a secular person, a materialist who believes matter is all there is, the other team keeps winning and you just got to lump it. No, there is no redemption. Bertrand Russell, one of the most famous atheists in the 20th century, I think, was a bit harsh but got it on the nose when he said, there is darkness without, and when I die, there will be darkness within. There is no splendor, no vastness anywhere, only triviality for a moment, and then nothing. That's resoundingly honest, and in some ways I applaud him for that. It's only the Christian gospel, it's only the gospel, the good news that Israel's God is going to return to the earth to fix everything, and that he's already begun the process of abolishing evil and death in and through Jesus. There's only that message proclaims that everything sad is going to come untrue. So you should really want it to be true. And that's why when you read the book that many of us have in this building, or even just download a Bible onto your phone if you don't have a Bible and just begin to look at some of the way that the people in it talk, they are filled, that even the Jewish scriptures before Jesus has come, They are filled with people singing songs of hope about a day when mountains flow with wine and deserts burst into bloom and trees clap and rivers bring life and healing to everything around them. And that's the kind of view of the world that Jews had, that in Jesus Christ, what happened, the Christians say, this has now begun. The definitive turning point in history has begun with the crucifixion and resurrection of the God-man Jesus, and that's going to mean everything sad now comes untrue. Just like what happened to Jesus will happen to us, it'll happen to all of creation as well. And that's unique to Jews and Christians, as far as I know. Everybody else, when faced with a question, is everything sad going to come untrue, says, if they're honest and they know what they're doing, they say no. Jews and Christians say yes. They say a resounding yes, and that's why they sing about it. And some of you, personality-wise, it's not your cup of tea to make as much noise as some of us do. That's fine. But the reality is that the thing people are singing about is not pie in the sky when you die. It's the transformation and renewal of all things and the knowledge that in what's happened to Jesus and our partnership with him, we have ourselves become part of a new creation, which will one day transform all things and remove all evil and all death from everything. And that's the Christian hope. So here's how the Christian story works. If you haven't heard it before, some of you haven't, or you've maybe heard it in a different way. So just very quick summary of the Christian story. God makes the universe. It's good, but it's not quite done yet. And then he puts human beings in it, and he says, you are going to carry my image and presence and rule to all corners of this earth I've made you as your home. And as you do, you will govern it, and you will take charge of it, and the bits of it that, if you like, are not quite done yet, you will end up going implementing. You'll take my presence, you'll work, and you'll bring harmony and joy where you go. Now, go, fill it, go on, rejoice, have dominion over it. And the human beings say, no. They say, we are going to decide what's right and wrong for ourselves, actually. And we're not going to do things just because you say that's what life looks like. We are going to have the knowledge of good and evil ourselves. We're going to decide whether we will do what you want or not. And as a result, the project gets radically damaged at the very beginning. And God makes a promise that day. When he sees what humans have done, he speaks to them. And then he says, there is going to come a day when a human being is going to come and live as I commissioned human beings to live. And what they're going to do is they're going to crush evil and death on the head, stamp it out permanently. But until that day, there's going to be a struggle. And then human beings go out and live. And the most of the rest of the Bible story then follows the story of the family through whom God said that this human individual who's going to crush sin and death is going to come from. So they basically follow them. And they're the people of Israel. It's Abraham's family. It just follows their family through and ups and downs. They look like they're about to wipe out evil and death. Oh, no, evil and death looks like it's going to wipe out them. And here they come. And oh, no, they don't. And that story is really important because it narrates the flow of how God is going to bring rescue to the world. And during that period, sometimes they're celebrating and saying, here it is, God's going to do it. Through our God, we shall do valiantly. Whoop, whoop. And then other times they say, actually, this is a total washout. And only if God comes and heals our brokenness is anything good ever going to happen. But they're effectively wrestling with that question. Is that which is sad going to come untrue? And their hopes are focused on this coming human individual they believe in, sometimes called a seed and sometimes called an anointed one or Messiah or a Christ if you speak Greek. And they're looking forward to this person who's going to come and do that. And then he comes. And he comes and he doesn't look like they expected. And he lives completely out of their categories because it doesn't come bang, suddenly everything is changed in an instant. Instead, he comes in and he starts telling stories. And he tells stories about little seeds getting bigger and about people being, what he got the master of a house disappearing and then coming back and finding that it, actually then at the end making all things right. And he tells stories about all sorts of, you know, people sowing seed and some of them work and some of them don't. And he tells all kinds of stories that puzzle a lot of the people who listen. But the stories he's telling and the things he's doing as he begins to speak healing and life over people who are marginalized and excluded, he says, this is what it looks like when the rule of God finally puts everything right. This is what it looks like when evil and death and all the things of Pakistan in the last few days and Nigeria and all these other things get made right. It doesn't look like suddenly God steps in and goes, bang, everybody dies. It actually looks like God puts something inside creation, like a gradually expanding, I was going to say ticking time bomb, but that sounds like a bad thing. Like gradually expanding and renewing. Like, well, an analogy he uses, he said it's like yeast in a lump of dough. And it gradually spreads like fungus. But it's a good fungus. because it transforms things from the inside out, and it gradually leavens and fills, and suddenly you know the smell of fresh bread, right? That wouldn't be there if it weren't for yeast, and it just gradually expands and fills and spreads. And that's how it's going to come. And then, as if to initiate that moment and that gradual transformation of the world, he dies and he says, I'm going to take all of the evil that everybody else in Abraham's family and everybody else in the world has ever done. I'm going to carry it on my shoulders and I'm going to die for it. And everything goes black. And then for 24 hours or a bit longer, 36 hours, there's a horrible, horrible silence as everybody wonders, is the plan for the redemption of the world, is the everything sad coming untrue thing, has that just stalled as it hit the rails against a couple of crossbeams because the Romans killed him? And then Easter Sunday morning comes and these weeping women through the tears are able to see somebody's taken him away. And someone says to them, I don't know what you're doing looking for living people amongst dead people for. And the proclamation of that message and the beginning transformation of the world starts with 1 and 2 and 12 and 120 and 3,000. It keeps going and spreading. Not in order to get the good guys out of the world, but in order to rescue the world, one person and then eventually all creation at a time. And that story continues in every nation on earth around the world today. So what happens to Jesus, i.e. he dies, takes because of evil, dies, and then rises again, that happens to those who partner with Jesus, what we call Christians. And they also, because as a result of evil and sin and death, they are going to die, you and I, right, are going to die. But then what happened to Jesus will happen to us. Resurrection, the turning around, not escape, but transformation, renewal, and then that happens to the whole of the world so that everything sad comes untrue and people look around and say, wow, there used to be a day when there were things like bereavements and miscarriages and divorces, and we've now lived in a world for thousands and millions of years where none of that's ever happened, and I just think it's bizarre that those things ever did. This world has been made new from the inside. Now, you may not believe that story, and that is fine. That's why I came, to help talk to you about it. But I want to put it to you that if the story's true, you should really want that. You should really want that. And whoever we are, we should want it to be true. We want the evil that's within us and within other people to be dealt with. And don't be the person who says, oh no, actually it's just the problems out there. If we could just get rid of Al-Shabaab, we'd be fine. Or if we could just get rid of Al-Qaeda, we'd be fine. Or just get rid of pedophiles, we'd be fine. Or just get rid of that. And we just go through the human race, just chopping people off. And initially, there's only a few of them. And then you think, yeah, but now we've got rid of Al-Qaeda. There's still these villainous people, but they're a bit less villainous than them, but they're more villainous than me, so we get rid of them. And then the next time I said, actually, there's still problems because other people are causing pain. It's a different kind of pain. They'd kill fewer people at once, but it's still pretty bad. Get rid of them, get rid of them, get rid of the people. And actually, marriages are damaged, so get rid of anybody who's ever failed in a marriage. And you start thinking, wow, some of us are beginning to go here. And gradually you whittle the world down until you're the most evil person in the world. You're the Hitler in this new world you've created, right? You're the person that people make references to and do impressions of to try and show this is what happens when the world goes wrong. Because you got rid of everyone who's worse than you. And at that point, I think we come face to face with the reality that if God is going to deal with the evil in the world, he's going to have to deal with us as well. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who won a Nobel Prize for Literature in the 80s, if you heard One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich or the Gulag Archipelago, he saw a lot of evil. He was a Red Army captain for Stalin, and then he got sent to the Gulag, and then he got sent to exile. So he had it was a bit of a bummer, I suppose you could say, like a triple whammy. And he, at the end of his life, he said, it would be great, wouldn't it, if we could just get all the villains over there and deal with them. But the line between good and evil goes through the middle of every human soul. And who's willing to give away a piece of himself? He's right. So we look, as Christians, we look for God to act on us as well as he acts in the world and to deal with evil and death as he said he would right back at the very beginning of the story. And we want sin. That's the Christian word for what I've just described. You might not like the word. It might sound a bit like too like, I don't know, oh, sin. Or that's like having a bit of chocolate. Or that, you know, there's that diet based on sins. Is anyone doing that diet? You won't admit to it if you are, I know, not in the context, but some of you are, I'm sure. You know, oh, I'm allowed to sin here. And take the word evil, it might be stronger, it might help you more. But actually, the evil in the world, and we want death to be undone. Not just human evil, everything, natural evil, all cancer, tornadoes, mosquitoes, anything like that, all go. No cholera. Yeah, I'm firing mosquitoes as well. I know that might not be my place, but that's what I feel like I'm entitled to do. And this nettles as well. They can go wasps, no thanks. But you want natural evil to be eradicated, as anybody who's seen or watched Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows knows. There's that tombstone, J.K. Rowling, again, with a very Christian frame of reference, has on the tombstone, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. That's the hope. That comes a quotation from a letter Paul wrote, which is, as it happens, and I'm very interested in it, I'm studying my PhD in that particular letter and that particular text, in fact, has been what I've been working on recently. Just thinking about the power of that statement, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. That's the hope. That's what people are hoping for. And an awful lot of the players in this big galactic football match, if you like, are saying, there's no such thing. Never happens. And the Christians and the Jews are on the terraces or actually in the match even just going, yes, it does. Yes, it does. You just need to wait. So I want to suggest, as I have now at some length, that you should want it to be true. Now, wanting that story to be true clearly doesn't mean it is. In fact, for some of us, it might make us think, if people want to believe something that badly, that actually makes it less likely. Because you just, it's like hope turned into reality, and that's why you want to believe it, so you do. In fact, it doesn't actually make it either more or less likely to be true, does it? If we're wanting it to be true, doesn't make it true, doesn't make it untrue. It just doesn't work that way. Sometimes we want things to be true because they are, like I want my hunger to be satisfied by food. And sometimes we want things to be true because they aren't, and they all lived happily ever after. There's no way of telling simply from the fact I desire something whether or not it's true. But if you have a desire, it does make you want to find out whether or not it's true. Given the difference, the story I've just told, which is held to by, again, it doesn't mean they're right, but somewhere between 1 and 2 billion people alive today, it's quite a lot. Given how much difference that story would make if the hope of the world had begun in Jesus and the last enemy to be destroyed is going to be death, and in between times, everybody who partners with Jesus gets their sins not just forgiven, but gradually transformed and turned into goodness as well. If that's the case, that makes a massive difference to your life and mine. So you should want to find out if it's true. And given that around a quarter of the world proclaims that story is true, including a huge number of history's leading artists, scientists, thinkers, philosophers, writers, we should investigate it. We should take it seriously enough to find out. That's all I'm trying to get to, by the way. My end point of today is try and find out if Christianity is true. Try and find out if the story I've just told is true. If it is, it makes every difference. I'm not trying to persuade. You can't persuade people of all of that stuff in half an hour. I wouldn't even try. Have some dialogue with you. I want to talk to you afterwards. We've got an evening this evening, which, to say, as Steve said, we'll take questions about lots of the tricky, thorny bits. What about this? But how does that fit in? I love doing that stuff. It'd be great. And Alpha, which Steve has mentioned and will mention again. And we had talked about a little story earlier on from Alpha. That's a great setting as well to talk about these things. But my challenge at the moment is not to try and shortcut all of that and say, there you go, it's true, I've proved it. It's just to make you think, do I want to find out if that's true or not? Does it matter? And the answer is, if you want everything sad to come untrue, it desperately, desperately matters. But I do want to say, whether or not you are convinced that it happened, I do want to suggest to you that that story, you want to find out about it, but it's also possible. It's certainly possible. All but the most very arrogant, angry atheist out there, and there's very few of them. Most atheists are very reasonable people. And all but the very weird, foaming at the mouth ones would say, do you know what? It's possible that God exists. I choose not to believe it at the moment, but it's possible. If it's possible that God exists, and God is understood as a being who can do anything he, she, it wants, and is all powerful and might well be very loving towards people, if that's possible, not even if it's certain, if it's possible, then the story I've just told is completely possible. It is very possible that God is saying, do you know what? I am transforming this thing gradually, but one day I'm going to destroy everything bad from it. At the moment, I'm waiting because a lot of the people who, if I destroyed evil, they'd have to just be destroyed too. And I'm waiting. I'm waiting for the yeast to spread through the dough. But when I do, when I come back, everything wrong is going to be righted. It's very possible, if there is a God, that that is exactly what he is both willing and able to do. So you can't write it off and say, this is lunacy. It just doesn't make any sense. It makes complete sense if there's a God. And I think you'd have to concede that the existence of God is at least possible. But the other thing I want to comment on is that unlike many stories, both religious and secular, you can investigate whether it's true or not. And that might sound odd because I'm talking about something that hasn't yet happened, the renewal of all things. But here's the connection, and this is the powerful test that the Christian gospel offers. The test is this: if Jesus Christ has been raised from the dead, then what's happened to him is extremely likely to happen to us and happen to the world. And if he hasn't, then the whole thing is a waste of time and you can all go home. And that's not a test I invented as a nice silky-tongued preacher from Eastbourne who goes da-da-da-da-da, and you get lulled into it. This actually goes right back to the letter I mentioned just now, a letter written to a city in southern Greece in 55 or 56 AD, maybe 54, who knows. And Paul put out this, the Apostle Paul put out this test, and he said, if Christ hasn't been raised, our preaching's useless, so is your faith. But Christ has been raised from the dead, and therefore we know that all things are going to be brought under his feet, and everything is going to be united, and shalom wins, and redemption wins. And that's the test for all Christians everywhere, even if they don't put it that way. This is the test. That's the thing on which the whole worldview swings. And basically, it's binary. It's, if it happened to Jesus, then it will happen to the world. If it didn't happen to Jesus, it won't. There's probably about three people in the world who think Jesus was raised from the dead and don't think it's going to happen to the world. And that's an eccentric view. But almost everybody lines up one or two sides there. They say, Jesus was raised and the world will have that happen to it. Or, no, he wasn't and no, it won't. And you can check that out. And that's the power of putting a test before you today, is that if Jesus was raised from the dead, then the Christian story looks extremely likely to be true. And if he wasn't, then the Christian story is certain to be untrue. And you can save yourself a lot of time just by finding out. If Jesus has been raised, everything sad will come untrue. If he hasn't, according to the Christian, no, it won't. So there, you can look into it. And you can study it, and you can find out and wrestle with things and look at evidence and look at, if you're into this sort of thing, look at, you know, sort of documents and studies and analysis and counter-arguments and rebuttals and all of those things, which I love doing. Some of you don't. Some of you just go, oh, just tell me the answer. Stop leaving me in suspense. I hope you know that the Christian answer to that question is yes, he was risen from the dead, and yes, it will happen to the world. And so as I wrap up, I'm not going to try and convince you that the resurrection's true in 5 minutes. It doesn't, again, work that way, but I will try and summarize 5 reasons why the evidence needs to be taken seriously, very quickly. First one, it's good to be open-minded about important stuff. You should take the evidence seriously because this is important. It does, really is the difference between one kind of future for the world and another, and that matters. And again, a quarter of the world believe Jesus rose, so we don't have to agree with those people, but you might have to concede that it is important if they're right. Second reason that you need to take the evidence for the resurrection and the Christian story seriously. Second reason, there's an impressive amount of documentary evidence for the resurrection. Now, some of you might go, oh, I can't do a science experiment. It's not on YouTube. I don't believe it. You think, well, in that case, you wouldn't believe in anything that hadn't happened before the invention of television. That's crazy. You wouldn't believe that there was such a thing as the Battle of Waterloo, and you wouldn't believe in Shakespeare. No, you do. We believe in things based on documents, just a question of whether we've looked into them. And first century terms, just take first century examples, there are 17 different documents that attest to the resurrection of Jesus. And there are none that respond to the claim and say he wasn't raised. Now, you don't count things like that, right? 17-0, you say, well, it's not quite as simple as that, because otherwise 17 of us could write a pamphlet saying David Cameron's married to a goat and the rest of them. So nobody ever rebutted it. You see, it must be true. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, actually, from a first century point of view, that's quite an impressive weight of evidence. Third reason to take it seriously is that the more people know about ancient Palestine, the more likely they are to believe in the resurrection. Now, that might sound like a bit of a shocker of a claim, but if you were to survey a group of sociologists, most people would say, I don't believe in the resurrection. If you surveyed a group of ancient historians, you'd find the number was a bit higher. If you went to the Society of Biblical Literature annual meeting, you would find the percentage had jumped significantly. And if you went to the British New Testament Society and talked to people who work in these documents all the time, I go to that conference as part of my research. When you go there and you survey people, you'd find a staggeringly high percentage of them believe in the resurrection. Far, far more than if you just did a poll of people in Bedford. The more people find out, the more likely they are to believe in it. That's the third reason. Fourth reason to take it seriously. Over 2,000 years of skepticism and outright hostility and persecution against people who preach that Jesus is risen from the dead. And again, we've seen a lot of that persecution this week. No viable alternative theory has emerged. You do not find anybody in the literature turning around and saying, to be honest, everybody knows that the resurrection was really just a question of this happening. there's enormous debate as to what possible alternatives we might have. And the fifth reason is, and I like this one because this is the way my mind works, that the best counter-argument to the resurrection is extremely weak. So what I want to do, I want to find who are the big boys who are really hitting out against the resurrection, saying this is a load of rubbish. So I want to find who is the leading New Testament heavyweight scholar who knows inside out everything about ancient Palestine and says, load of rubbish, here it is, here's the book to prove it. And you buy that book, it was written about 4 years ago by Geza Vermes, who translated the Dead Sea Scrolls and was Oxford Emeritus Professor. He's a big cheese. He writes, he's not a Christian, writes a book about it and says, here's what I think happened. And what he does basically goes, you can read it, buy it in Waterstones, it's very interesting. He goes, here's all the evidence. Basically everybody, there was an empty tomb and lots of people had experiences of Jesus after that. And all of the alternative theories people have put forward don't work. Hallucination, that's just stupid. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes Jesus didn't really die. Nobody believes this. Nobody believes that. And you kind of think, he's about to become a Christian. And then at the very end, he says, to be honest, the reason we don't believe in the resurrection is because we're scientific people and we know that that couldn't have happened. At which point, I find myself inside going, if that is the best response you have, you are saying the only way you could say the resurrection didn't happen is that if you assumed that there wasn't a God before you even started. Because right? If there's a God, he can do anything, right? You can't say, oh, no, maybe there's a God, but this definitely didn't happen. That doesn't follow. You can't say that. You have to say, if there might be a God, then what? And that's the goal. That's some of the things we're going to be looking into tonight. So I'd encourage you, look into it. Right? That's the punchline. You should want this story to be true if you're a human and you care about the future of the world. And if you want this story to be true, it's worth finding out if it is. And to be honest, the whole thing rises or falls on the resurrection of Jesus. Tonight, we're going to spend an evening engaging with any questions you like, except for the one that your son was. What was that one? Something. What makes a blue firework? I don't know. So there are some exceptions, and I won't answer the one about where babies come from either, because I've been stitched up with that before. But other than that, right? Any questions? I do know, I'd just like to say, but that's not going to answer that. But we will answer any other questions you might have. We'll discuss it openly. If I don't know, I'll be honest about it, and we'll talk about that. So you might want to come tonight, or you might want to come on Alpha, and Steve's going to lead into that as we close. Let me just ask for just God to come and meet with us and encourage us and bless you, and then we'll wrap up. Father, I really ask for every sincere seeker after truth in this place, whether people who are already Christians, or people who don't know if they are, or people who are pretty sure they're not. I pray that you would help all of us by your Spirit find what you have for us in Jesus. Some of us don't even believe that that's a right sentence. That's okay. I pray you bless them nonetheless. I pray for those who do. I pray some of us are celebrating, yes, God, please reveal yourself to me. But I pray, God, that we would actually be able to put this test in front of people and that you would lead people to a place of decision by your Spirit. We thank you so much for this astonishing story that everything's sad comes untrue because of what's happened in and through Jesus. And we ask, hasten that day and equip us to play our part in seeing it happen in the now. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. 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 Steve.